Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Tom Lounges. Thank you for joining us here on Lakeshore Public Radio. It's time for Midwest Beat, a program all about music and the people who make it. Well, tonight we're going to talk to, or today rather, we're going to talk to a gentleman who's been making music a good many years. Many songs you are familiar with, many songs that were top 40, and then some that are more serious. In fact, some of his latest songs, his latest album, in fact, we're going to profile and spotlight is Sobering Times. The title kind of says it all. We're talking about Mr. Ricky Bird. He has played with as a member of the Blackhearts with Joan Jett. He has been a sideman and a session player with the likes of Todd Rundgren, Roger Daltrey, and others. We'll be joining Ricky after this. Stay with us. Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for supporting Public Radio. I'm Tom Lounges. This is Lakeshore Public Radio at 89.1 FM on the dial and streaming worldwide at lakeshorepublicradio.org. This program, as you know, is all about music and the people who make it. And normally I have multiple guests, but today my guest is so special that we're going to do the whole show with him. So strap down and get ready to rock and roll, because my guest is Mr. Ricky Bird. We're going to get into his latest album. We're going to talk about his career, and we're just going to have a great time today. And maybe you remember this one. All right. Ow! If you love rock and roll, I bet you've put a few dimes in the jukebox, or make that quarters these days, or 50 cents or a dollar, who knows how much it is. But I bet you put a lot of money into the jukebox playing songs that Ricky Bird has played on. Not only was he a member for many years of Joan Jett's Blackhearts and was there for the heyday of that band, including those songs, but he also has been a sideman and a session player with some great talents and major names over the years, like Todd Rundgren and Roger Daltrey. But right now, we're here to talk about Ricky's latest projects, and it's got a message behind it. Let's play the first song from Sobering Times, his brand new album, and we'll have Ricky on the phone after this, because it is Quitting Time Again. New music, Ricky Bird on Lakeshore. Enjoy, and turn it up. It sure would be something. Stop me, yeah. I run.
You low down, sorry, excuse for life. Kiss my ass.
Quitting time again, sobering times. That title relates in so many ways these days. Sobering times indeed. That is new music from Ricky Bird. He is one of the guitar greats that you have heard on so many songs on your radio and probably didn't even realize it. He's played with so many people. Of course, he was a longtime member of Joan Jett's Blackhearts, but he's been making records on his own for quite a while too. I remember discovering young Ricky Bird back in the day. There was an album that came, a promo copy, that came to the radio station by a band called Susan. And I remember being very impressed with the album cover. It had a beautiful blue Bel Air on it, and I'm a kind of a car geek. So I looked at that, and I saw this car, and I looked at those songs, and I put it on, and it was very pop-friendly, as music was back around 79, 80, I think that album came out. And we started listening and playing to that album, and didn't hear much from Susan after that. But then this guy, Ricky Bird, popped up on the radar with everyone else, and we went back and said, that was the kid, that was the guy. And we're going to get to a long-lost song from Susan a little later in the show, but right now let's bring on the man himself, Mr. Ricky Bird. How are you, Ricky?
Was I ever really young, Tom? That's what I want to know.
Were any of us ever really young?
Yeah, that was a long time ago, brother.
Yeah, it was. Oh, man. I still have the pre-release blue vinyl of Susan. And
everybody, when somebody remembers Susan, they always remind me, oh, I had the blue vinyl.
Yep, I got the regular album too, but I did get the blue vinyl. Now, let's talk, first of all, we're going to go back and we're going to reflect on some of the great things you've done throughout your career. But right now you're on a mission, and that is basically to help others. As you know, any of us that are in the music business for any length of time, you cannot avoid meeting people who have become subject to temptation and addiction and other things, the underbelly of the rock and roll, and not even the rock and roll, but the music business. I mean, even Charlie Parker was dancing with Mr. D back in the day. But
Billie Holiday.
But you are a pro anti-drug get sober kind of rehab promoting guy these days, and I commend you for that. And your last couple of albums, Clean Getaway and the new one Sobering Times, both enforce that belief and your mission, I guess you'd say. I don't know if I'm putting too much credibility on the fact that you're trying to beat the drum for sobriety or not, and I'm going to let you tell that story. What is the story behind a song like Quitting Time Again?
Well, I mean, first of all, that sounded damn good, man. I haven't heard, I mean, this is the first time I've heard it played back to me, you know, on the radio or something. I'm like, well, that's a single. That sounds good.
Right.
Well, let's see. Beating the drum for recovery. Yeah, I could say that. I mean, I'm not promoting anything as far as, I'm not like, you know, Mr. Freaking Recovery, but maybe I am. But I'm trying to, it's more like attraction than promotion. So I'm trying to like show people that there's another way to live. And in the songs on this record and the last one, Clean Getaway, I'm trying to lay it without preaching because that I'm not that guy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to put the cards on the table. So, you know, hopefully you see something or hear something that you might need to hear. And I try to put a solution in every song, which in that song, it's where I say, you know, you low down life, kiss my ass, right?
Right.
There's the solution right there. So that's what I try to do is just like put the information out there. Some of the songs, you know, there's a nod and a wink in some of the stuff. But you know, it's all serious business, but I try to make it rock. I mean, it's a rock and roll record first and foremost, but it has a message of, you know, recovery rocks. How's that?
Okay. I like that. I like that. How did Clean Getaway go over? Because it did have the same similar message to it. And the fact you are putting it out pretty much on your own, self-producing, self-writing, recording, things like that. And it's both a positive and a negative in today's world. As you know, you came from the record label days. Susan was part of the Tommy Mottola scene, RCA Records and Millennium Records. And then Joan, she did. When I first met Joan, her and Kenny were literally selling the album, the first album, out of their trunk. That was the old school way. And then, of course, CBS came along, picked it up, and you guys became MTV stars. And now you're back to square one, kind of doing
now
it all
selling
yourself.
Selling it out of my trunk.
There you go. So how has it been as far as coming full circle, and how did Clean Getaway get received?
It got received amazing. I mean, for what I was doing and for the level that I was doing it at, I don't have a record label per se. I mean, it was on... what was it on? Recovery Troubadour Records. I mean, that's just me. I just put I just made that up, right? Because I'm a Recovery Troubadour. but somebody asked me the other day, because I've been on this interview wheel, what's success to you? And so success to me now is when I get a message from somebody that hears one of these records, because I've been sending this out. People have been pre-ordering this for like a year and a half, and I've been sending out digital copies once it was done, you know, once it was actually done.
Right.
So people have been hearing the music that pre-ordered. When somebody writes me and says, you told my story, you helped me stay clean last night, you know, these songs are just helping me have a better day in recovery. I mean, does it get any better than that? You know, no. Yeah, everybody wants to sell freaking 100,000 records, but like the point is that I'm getting out of this what I wanted to get out of this. In other words, I'm helping people, I'm attempting to help people who are struggling with addiction, and you know, including alcoholism and everything else. I'm trying to talk to people that are in long-term recovery and saying, you know, yeah, remember this, you know. This is why we're in recovery. I'm thanking the people that support the recovery lifestyle, and I'm trying to make good loud rock and roll for people that love good loud rock and roll. So, yeah, I mean, I got a coolest song in the world on Little Steven's Underground Garage, you know, which was great. So that got me to do some interviews on there, and that let me spread the message. It's all about spreading the message, man, you know?
Right.
It's like there's a song on the record, I Ain't Gonna Live Like That, and that's the deal. It's like if you don't want to live like that anymore, there's a way out. And, you know, today, you know, September 25th, which is today here, I'm celebrating 33 years, you know, in recovery. So
congratulations.
And, you know, it's cliche to say, if I could do it, anybody could do it. But, hey, man, if I could do it, anybody could do it.
Right.
That's the bottom. That's how simplistic this is. I mean, these songs germinated from germinated? Is that the right word?
Yes.
maybe I should call Dr. Fauci. Ask him if that's the right word. From me doing these songs in recovery music groups at treatment facilities, where I'm actually playing in front of clients that are in there, you know, they're in rehab, and I'm playing these songs. And the reaction that I got from them was what kind of keeps making me press on. It's like they come over to me after the meeting and after the group, and they, man, you told my story, or you made me cry. Like the big tough guy will say, you just made me cry, you know, with that. So I think I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing. I think I think I got a handle on how to write these songs. And from the response I get from people, I think I'm doing a good job. And this record, I'm just trying to take it up a notch. And it's interesting because, you know, I have my website, rickybird.com. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you could buy, well, now it's officially out, I guess, whatever that means these days. But you could get it on rickybird.com. But also in the last month, I was offered a really cool distribution deal, you know, like, with the big boys. So hopefully that's going to take, we're doing the legal stuff now, and once we sign the papers, it's going to take a little while to get the music. Like, the digital music could probably be up in a month on, like, Apple Music and iTunes and all that stuff. But this, getting the physical around the world is going to take a little time, maybe November or so.
Okay.
But it's cool, man, because the more I get it out there, the more I spread the message. And as far as selling a lot of records, yeah, that'd be fabulous, too. But my thing is, like, when I go to these recovery music groups that I do, not only in treatment facilities, but I've been to high schools, I've been to juvenile detention center. I was out in Seattle 2 years ago. Obviously, I'm not doing anything right this minute, but I do recovery events where I'm like a keynote speaker and stuff. But when I do the treatment facilities, I bring a stack of the Clean Getaway records and I give them to the clinical directors to hand out to the clients when they complete their treatment so they could take the message home with them. So, yeah, like anything I make kind of goes back into, you know, giving them out and stuff like that and paying off the studio and this. And if there's something left over, you know, maybe I'll buy myself a new guitar or something.
There you go. So with this album, Sobering Times, how much did you write this? I'm a big fan of sequencing, and a lot of people don't even realize the importance of sequencing. But these songs really flow together. And the same thing with your past albums. How much time do you take in the sequencing option? And for those that are listening that don't understand that term, it means the order of the song so that they make sense to the listener and the artist. So when you're hearing them, you're not hearing just sound bites. You're hearing the whole album the way the artist wanted you to hear it. And that's also very important if you're a fan of the artist to hear what the message of the music is. How much time did you spend on sequencing? And were these songs written entirely for this particular album? Or were you sitting on some of them?
Oh, no. These Clean Getaway, I probably had some extras. And I mean, I don't even think I looked at any of those for this record, but I started from scratch and all new songs. But yeah, man, sequencing, hey, you should be in my brain. I drove myself and everybody else insane. I'm like a big, you know, it would have been fabulous if I could have. I was just talking to somebody else about this the other night. Like, you know, there's 12 songs on this,
right?
And there was 12 songs on Clean Getaway. So the first thing is like, oh, man, how many songs do I put on the record? Because I had like, I don't know, 17 to narrow it down. And so then what I do in my sick brain is I start Googling big albums, you know, by the Stones, by the Beatles. Oh, wait, this one had 15 songs. Wait, this one had 9. Oh, this one had 13. Well, actually, 13. I found not a lot of people put 13 on their record for, I guess, I don't know, superstition. I don't know why. But so there was that, how many songs to put on. Then I got, like I did with Clean Getaway, there's 12 steps in a 12-step spiritual program. Let me put 12 songs. You know, that was just a little personal behind-the-scenes thing for me.
Okay. I wouldn't have even thought of that. That's a nice comparison there.
Yeah, so that's that. And then it's like, okay, wouldn't it be cool if I could do it, like put the songs on there in order of the 12 steps. So kind of it goes through this and I'm like, oh, I'm way out of my pay grade here. You know,
now call Dr.
Really,
Phil.
Yeah. You're going to have to lock me up if I try to do that. So then I just was like, okay, let me put it in a really cool order. So luckily in this day and age, you could put your, you know, you upload it onto your iTunes and then you could just keep moving the stuff around until you find something that feels good, you know, and listen, in the middle of this, after like 2 weeks of moving songs around and then changing your mind, I said to myself, wouldn't it be ironic if I found out that Abbey Road, they put the songs in a hat and they just picked them out and threw them on the freaking thing. You know, I'm sure that's not what happened, but that would be ironic because I'm going crazy here.
Wow.
And, you know, like at first the song Together, the big glam song, it's number 2. But on the record, but it starts off with that really cool kind of Queenish harmony, "Let the Light In," that you've been fighting. And I said, "Wow, that's probably a cool opening song." And I said, "But you know what? Quitting Time is like solid as a rock. Like when that guitar comes in, bam, 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 bam. Like if I was just listening, that would knock me off the couch." So that's why I went with that first, Quitting Time, and then Together. So and then I had a song that I played on mando guitar. And so now I'm starting to think like the Beatles, like, okay, let's throw a curveball and put like a mando acoustic cool gratitude song on there. Mm-hmm. So that's how I thought about it. And then it's like, okay, now it's time for a sloppy rock and roll song. So that's where Tired comes in. So, you know, like I have a plan in my head, but it's just getting it, you know, you'll always wind up with two slow songs next to each other, no matter what you do. It's always going to wind up like that. But, yeah, I think you can overthink it. And the main thing is I wanted it to have a great opening song. And the last song, just like you, I do in treatment, and it really brings, you know, a lot of emotion from the clients that I play to, because it's about, well, it's what it says, just like you. So it's me talking to them, saying, hey, man, I know what you're going through. Mm-hmm. I've been there myself. You know, just listen to the lyrics. You know, I was just like you. And it goes through the different stages of being a newcomer into having some time. And I wanted to end it like that, like on that note, positive. And also, like Clean Getaway, I ended with Broken is a Place, which is a beautiful ballad. So I always like ending the, you know, some may think that you want to end the song with a giant rock and roll tune, but I like ending it with like a lullaby kind of.
Right. Well, it also, by alternating, like you said, opening with Quitting Time, a rocker, before you did like a more melodic, overt song like Together, which we're going to get to here in a second. And then closing with a ballad, it prevents ear fatigue. You're not hearing the same thing constantly. It's keeping your senses alert. And we're going to play that one. Is there a story behind Together on how that and why that made the album?
Yeah, you know, and it had nothing to do with what we're going through now in the world.
Okay.
I wrote it probably maybe right at the beginning when I started to write for this record. So, you know, almost going back 2 years. I just wanted to, I started writing the words. Well, no, let me take that back. I always start with a guitar in hand. So I started playing the chords and then I start mumbling like a melody and, you know, no lyrics in particular, just like mumbling.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny because when I co-write with somebody, they always go, What'd you say? And I'm like, I didn't say anything, man. I was just mumbling. And, no, that's great. What'd you say? So I must be a good mumbler or something.
I guess.
But I started to write about, I mean, you just listen to the lyrics when you play it, people will understand. And the thing about recovery is we're in this together. Like, you know, we all have our own stories. We all have our own variables. We all come from different places, different families, different towns, different countries. But the thing that's common amongst addicts and alcoholics is when you do the first one, all bets are off.
Right.
So, and when you're in recovery, that's the thing. That's one of the big things that keep you, you know, on the path is that you lean on other people. That's why people go to community support group meetings. It's like, you know, it's always like isolation. Addiction thrives on isolation. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Like when you're alone in your own head is when you justify using or no, I'll do it differently this time or, you know, just one more or I wasn't that bad or I got this. You know, those are all phrases that you say right before you pick up. So that's why me personally, I always like to run stuff by. I mean, I'm constantly talking to people that are in recovery and sometimes it's about baseball, man. But I have a support group that I've been talking to, you know, and it changes as the years go on. But so that's what that song is about. We're in this together. No need to go it alone. You know,
all right.
It's simple. The message is simple.
We're going to play it now. We'll be back with Ricky Bird. We'll talk more about the new album. We'll go back a little bit into his celebrated career, and you never know what he's up to next. This is Together off Sobering Times.
I've never let the world know I was hurting. That kind of thing. for seconds. You run that game on yourself till you just can't run anymore.
We're in this together. New music, Sobering Times, Ricky Bird, a song about support, about not facing your demons on your own, and you'll have a whole lot more success if you got that backing team cheering you on.
Timely too, huh?
Yeah, very much so. The whole catchphrase now is together alone, but now that's the anti-claim here.
Right, and I can't tell you how gratifying it is to hear these songs being played back to me like this. I'm like, that's the first time I'm hearing them like this.
Well, we're happy to do it. You mentioned, listeners, in case you just tuned in, my guest is Ricky Bird. He has played with everybody in rock and roll practically. He started back in the 70s and was a longtime member of Black Hearts with Joan Jett. But this is the anniversary, 30 years of sobriety for Ricky. And
33
years, I correct that.
Trying to jip me out of 3 years, man.
What was the turning point? What was the key in the lock that said, okay, I'm done? I mean, you lived the rock and roll lifestyle. You were there on the tours and the MTV years, and it was a pretty wild time. I lived through it too, barely. So what was it that made you say it's time?
Well, you just said it. I'm done. You know, so when I was turning 30, I mean, listen, I started using like a lot of teenagers when I was 13, you know, smoking pot, you know, like innocently enough, like a lot of us did. Who the hell knew that you had? I mean, I have this in my genes. Like my dad died directly from alcoholism. His father died of it. You know, I got some people in recovery in my family. So, there's that side of it, right? The one thing that I noticed when I started, when I was 13, and I was like a quiet kid, shy, grew up in the Bronx, right up the block from Yankee Stadium. I had to say that. you could see the stadium glow from our kitchen window. How's that for romantic?
That's cool.
New York?
Yeah.
So, you know, I was kind of a quiet, shy kid. You know, as soon as I saw the Beatles and the Stones on Ed Sullivan, I was like sold. But the thing is, like, when I smoked that first joint, you know, like a lot of my friends, we were all, you know, about the same age. I felt this weight kind of off my shoulders. Like, life didn't feel so oppressive. I had a great childhood, but you follow what I'm saying? It's like,
right.
I felt like, oh, this is interesting. How long has this been going on? You know, now some of my friends might have been once in a while people, right? But I was like addicted to more. So once I got a taste of that, like life is more interesting on this end of the freaking mirror. Like I just kept going, and even with pot, like I never smoked one joint. I was always like, you know, smoke them until you're out, and then go find some more. So that was like, that was my pattern, right? And then as you get older, you start being introduced to other stuff.
Right.
Of course, booze probably started with beer. I started getting into bands when I was about, I don't know, 14, 15, junior high school maybe. Well, that's high school at that point. You know, you get into bands and people bring six packs and you start drinking. You know, I was all in, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then I started hanging out in rock clubs in the city with older people, some of the famous rock clubs like Max's Kansas City, Nobody's, the Mercer Arts Center. I mean, if you just Google that stuff, they were all famous rock clubs in Manhattan in the 70s. Max's was around since the 60s. It was right. An art kind of Andy Warhol place. But in the early 70s, it started to turn into more of a like a glam, glittery, you know, Rod Stewart-y kind of, you know, place where all the bands, when they played in Manhattan, they played the Garden or something, they'd always wind up at Max's. So I started hanging out there, and I was only 16, hanging out with older people, and they turned me on to other stuff, you know, like pills, hard liquor, mm-hmm. you know, Southern Comfort, Jack Daniels is where I settled. and it was because of my two heroes, right? Frank and Keith drank Southern Comfort, drank Jack Daniels.
Yeah.
Now, Janice drank Southern Comfort, but oh my God, what a god-awful taste that had. especially the last one at 4 a.m. when it burns your throat and you can't get it down.
Hmm.
But so now I'm increasing mixing, matching. And then all of a sudden, like the end of the 70s came, and it was all still, you know, nobody got hurt. I mean, there were people that died, of course. But there were, in my crowd, it was still, yeah, you'd have a hangover. Sometimes you'd wake up in a strange place, but you were still just teenagers. You had no responsibilities, really. So the consequences were what they were, and you kind of just brushed them off. Like when you start getting to be an adult and you're still doing the same stuff and you're just not showing up for stuff, and then it starts getting bad.
Right.
And then somewhere around 79, 78, 79, 80 is when cocaine came into the...
Right. Became the drug of choice.
Yeah, and that just completely, that was the end. That was it for me. That was the beginning of the end. I should have known from the first one. So that took another, and I had some near misses life-wise. Something really serious happened in 83 with my lung from that. But it took until 87 until I finally got to the point. So now I'm doing everything, more or less. Heroin was not my, like right at the end, there were a little couple of snorting incidents.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I never put a needle in my arm or anything, but cocaine was the thing. But you know, you do that and then you get too wired. You take a couple of pills and then you drink on top of it. You know,
right.
you're like insane.
Right. It's completely insane. You know, you get done with a gig, you got to do a Valium to go to sleep. You got to take a Black Beauty to get up.
Yeah,
you get in that cycle.
You get in the cycle.
And so, accessibility too. The era you're talking about. I mean, everything was prevalent. Everybody was holding at some point, especially in the circles that you ran in, and in the club business. I mean, I was in clubs. I was around
exactly.
Well, and it you don't think about it. It becomes second nature. Becomes part of your daily routine.
And let me tell you, I remember going to the Ritz in Manhattan, a big club. You know, big stage, a lot of people. And I remember going to see somebody and being really excited to see somebody that I couldn't wait to see. It could have been like Chuck Berry or somebody. And dude, I spent the entire show in the bathroom, you know, getting high. He's doing his last song. It's like, fine, I can hear it from in here. you know, but the point is, I do want to make something, make a point here. Like, I never really... Like, I could count on a couple of fingers the times when I was wasted on stage.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, did I smoke a joint before? Yeah, of course. Did I have a beer or two? Yeah. But I only did coke before a show like two or three times, and it was just the worst. I mean, anybody that knows what that's like, it's like two songs in, it's like I needed more.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like you could actually leave the stage and say, I'll be back in a few.
Right.
So I didn't really do it on stage. It was like after the show. It was either staying, you know, in the hotel or traveling on the bus. And of course, off the road, we were just total maniacs when we got home.
Right.
And people say, man, was everybody getting high? It's like, no, not everybody was like getting crazy as much as me and a few of the others were. But the people, I tended to hang with the people that were.
Right.
Who the hell wants to hang out with people that aren't getting that way when you're that way?
Exactly.
Yeah. So back, so around, I'm turning 30, you know, like 86 or whatever the math is. And, I said, I'm done. I was like 128 pounds. Like I was doing way too much blow, like, you know, spending way too much on it, doing stupid shit like selling, you know, guitars like on the spot. Like you didn't have any cash and, you know, you needed something. And you say, hey, man, how much you give me for this?
Right.
You know, all that stuff that you read about. Just all the stuff that comes along with it. It's like horrible nonsense. You know, people like ODing in your apartment, you know, and it's like all this weird shit. And I said, I'm done. So I was turning 30, and I have my diary from that year, from 30, from October, I guess it's October of 86, mm-hmm. to September. I'm trying to do this in my head, to September of 87. I have my diary, right? And every day it's the same. It's like, tonight, we're going to go out for dinner. I am not going to, you know, nothing. I'm going to have club soda. And for a whole year, it's the same story. I wound up, you know, talking myself into having just a beer. Oh, that's not going to hurt.
Right.
You know, but what it does is it, for somebody that's, you know, has the predisposition for addiction, it sets off a chain reaction in your brain that becomes, you know, not necessarily the first beer, but it sets off an obsession craving thing that happens. And so, right. You know, one beer is like, well, I'm fine. I'll have another one.
So,
you know, two or three beers in, then you switch to hard liquor. And then before you know it, you're making phone calls, right?
So you made the conscious decision in 87 to get sober,
yep.
And it took a while because you kept slipping back, it sounds like.
No.
No?
No. I made the decision in 86 when I was turning 30, and it took me to a month before my 31st birthday to realize that I couldn't do it by myself, which is back to that song again.
Right.
By coincidence, some say there are no coincidences, in August of that year, we were at a wedding, and sitting next to us was a friend we used to use with. And I leaned into her, and I, you know, whispered those two of my favorite words back then, which were, "You holding?" You know, and like a radio DJ at Jay
Voice.
Right. And she said, "No, I'm going to these places, and you know, I don't do that anymore, and I'm, you know, I'm in recovery." And I was like, "Oh, that's just what I wanted right now." You know, good for you. You know. But she kept talking, and I kept, you know, I guess a part of me was listening, and part of me was looking for somebody else.
Right.
And a month later, man, 2 o'clock in the morning, I'm standing in front of the mirror, and like my nose is bleeding. I'm like, you know, you always want to look like Keith, baby, and it's like, I think you've surpassed him.
Well, you got to hit that rock bottom to climb your way up. You know, when you can't go any lower.
Yeah, and everybody's got rock bottoms that are different, you know.
Exactly.
I mean, I never went to jail, you know, none of that stuff. But I was looking in the mirror. I was drunk. I was high. I was done. And I picked up the phone. I called Jill, and she took me the next day to a community support group meeting. And that's it. September 25th, 87, clean and sober, done.
And you have to be wanting to do it. You can't just let your parents or your friends or whatever say, oh, you got to do this. I mean, intervention is one thing, but you really have to want it to do it. Otherwise, you're destined to fail.
Yeah, well, you could get sober. You could get sober in your brain for other people, but it never worked. You know, I'm not going to ever say never, but, you know, until you're doing it for yourself because you don't want to die.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, listen, man. There's a real good chance that if I just would have kept going. I mean, I almost died once, you know, in 83.
Right.
So if I would have kept going, something horrible would have happened, and that would have been the end of the story. So you got to want to do it. Like it's a life or death decision, you know. But the thing is, you don't have to do it alone. So once I got into the community support group vibe, I started following suggestions. I started doing what people that came before me did, and it all worked out. So far, you know, as of today, it's worked out. Have I made goofy, horrible errors in judgment in 33 years? Oh, freak yeah.
Yeah, right.
But I haven't picked up a drink or drug. And after all, that's why I walked into that room, was to not drink or drug. And you learn to get better as time goes on. You make mistakes. As long as you don't pick up a drink or drug, you could, you know, figure a way around it, make amends, right your wrongs. And hopefully learn better for the next time. And that's what it's been like. And I've had some tough times career-wise in recovery.
Right.
But still, I never picked up over it, which is like, wow, that's your victory right there, you know? And now I have a wonderful, wonderful career, like putting out music that helps other people. Hopefully, it's still my rock and roll. You know, it's you listen to this record and you go, well, that reminds me of this. It's like, dude, my music is, I'm a product of everything I listened to when I was 13 to like, you know, 20.
Mm-hmm.
And that includes Mötley Hoople, Slade, The Stones, The Kinks, with Wilson Pickett, Otis Redding, Al Green, you know.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned Slade. We just had Naughty on last week. We had him on for almost 2 hours. He was a trip.
Dude, I got drunk with him in England at a pub once.
There's some great stories that come out of post or pre-recovery days. The thing is, a lot of times you can't remember it all.
I remember this because it was Naughty Holder from Slade, and I love Slade. I remember we were in a place, and word came to us that Johnny Thunders had passed away, and it happened to be wrong at that point. It happened eventually, but it was wrong. And we were like, let's raise a glass for Johnny. You know, we got into that whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember that.
It was funny because
a lot of stories.
When Johnny, I met Joan. She was playing his place in Chicago. I can't remember the name of the joint, but Johnny Thunders was playing in the upstairs club, and she was playing in the downstairs club. And that's when they were selling the album out of the trunk, her and Kenny.
Wow.
And I did an interview with her. I think it was for Relics Magazine or somebody. And but Johnny, I was a big Johnny fan because of the Dolls. I had worked with David and a bunch of the guys in the band over the years. And, you know, it was funny because when you mentioned Johnny and you were with Joan, I just see this parallel. It was just made me think of the Joan Jett days. And on that, let's touch on that for a minute. When and how did you tie in with Joan Jett? I mean, you were there with the second album and stayed for a while.
Well, the first record was a Joan record.
Right, that was done.
Yeah, so the first Blackheart record was I Love Rock and Roll.
Mm-hmm.
And before I get into this, since you're in Chicago, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're in Chicago?
Yep.
I remember, and I just Googled it because I couldn't remember when it was. One of the great moments with Jett, and there were many, of course, was we were playing the, what's the thing on the water?
Oh, Navy Pier, Chicago Fest.
We were playing Chicago Fest, and Sinatra was playing also the same day. So he went on at probably 8 o'clock, and we went on when he finished, obviously, different stages. I'll never forget as long as I live, man, because I'm a huge Sinatra fan. I'm in the trailer, and I'm getting ready, and some guy comes in, like in a tuxedo, says, who's the Frank fan? And I was like, that's me. He says, well, come with me. And I stood on the side of the stage, not just me, but and watched part of his show from the side of the stage and singing, you know, Chicago, shit. And I was like, whoa, this is like sick,
little
man.
Taste of heaven.
Yeah, so like those are the kind of perks you get, you know, that kind of cool stuff.
Right.
So what happened with Joan, I'll run you through this real fast. I do that first record with Susan. That's in 79, mm-hmm. I guess, right?
Yep.
That last one tour. And we wound up at the Academy of Music in New York, and then Tom Dickey, or the other guitar player, left the band. I remember he had a separate dressing room, so we knew things were not good at that point.
Yeah.
And he started his own band, and then we tried to go on for a little while, but we couldn't get any traction, you know, as a three-piece, or we added somebody else. And then I was kind of like, okay, so what do I do next? Well, the next thing that happened is we were signed to Tommy Mottola's management company, Champion Entertainment, who also had Hall & Oates. And so G.E. Smith became a friend of mine, and he was he left Hall & Oates. He was doing a solo record. He said, would you like to tour with me as my second guitar player? I said, yeah, why not? So I toured with him for his solo record, and we were opening for Squeeze, which was fabulous. Mm-hmm. I think it was the Attempted tour.
Okay.
And actually,
record.
The Susan tour, we were opening up for Graham Parker and the Rumor, and it was squeezing out the spark. So I've been really lucky with these tours, right? So I toured with G.E., then I come back to New York, and I'm working. Somebody thought, from Chrysalis, thought that I would be a good matchup with John Waite, because he had just left the Babies and moved to New York. So we started hanging out and writing. Then Carol, my wife, Carol Kay, not the bass player, she worked at Lieber Krebs, which is a, you know, was a giant management company back then.
Right.
And they had... you know, one of the people they managed along with Aerosmith and Ted Nugent. So it was Humble Pie. And Humble Pie was like one of my favorite bands. Right?
I got drunk many times with Stevie at the bar. He used to play at my club.
Yeah, so there you go. I got to have to finish that story. But
yeah.
we became really good friends, and we used to hang out. I used to go over to his apartment all the time in the village, and we'd sit there with guitars, and, you know, he'd sing that loud in the living room. And, you know, there was, you know, he was talking to me about maybe, like, joining up with, the last version of Humble Pie to me, which was like, what? You know, I was 20-something, right? I was like, you're kidding me. But, and then Carol said, do you know who Joan Jett is? I said, yeah, from the Runaways. And she said, well, she's looking for a guitar player. Would you like to go down and play with her? I said, yeah. So I went down, I can't remember even where, to a rehearsal studio probably. And we played, we got along great. And I joined the band, and we went in and did the Isle of Rock and Roll record, which some of it was already already recorded with Eric Amble, who's a great guitar player, great mm-hmm. producer. There's a couple of little bits that are left on there, like Little Drummer Boy. He played the Break in Crimson and Clover. But we started recording it, you know, A to Z. And we hit the road, and we're playing joints, you know, we're playing clubs. I think we were in a Winnebago, if I remember correctly. Remember, it's a long time ago.
Right.
And the record comes out, and it just starts going up the charts. And, you know, every time we get to another town, somebody would say, hey, man, it's like number 40. It's number 30. It's number 12, you know. And then all of a sudden, it's number one. So now the Winnebago goes away, and we have like a tour bus, and then we have two tour bus. It's just like, Spinal Tap, man.
Yep. It progresses.
You know, it's that whole thing. And we're playing big places, and we start opening for really, you know, bands that you grew up listening to, like, you know, The Who, Deep Purple, and ZZ Top, and Aerosmith. And, you know, we would go on those, like, 80s package gig tours with, like, Journey and REO Speedwagon. I remember I had a cool bag. I don't know what the hell. I'm looking at my shelves. I don't know what happened to it. REO Speedwagon, Loverboy. You know, we'd do that stuff. And then we would play our own shows. And yeah, so I played with him from 81 to 91. At around 91, it was time for me to, you know, see what else was out there, you know, to just do other stuff, you know. I mean, I love playing with Joan. I love Joan. We had an amazing time together. You know, we made rock and roll history together. And, you know, I'm in the Rock Hall because of Joan.
That's right.
You know, God bless her.
For those
I wanted to do some other stuff. So I got a couple of publishing deals, one after another. Stayed home, wrote, tried to find out what I sounded like. That took a long time because, you know, everything, I put together bands, and it was kind of a tag job, Rolling Stones. Like, I couldn't quite find out who I was until I figured out just be, you know, what I told you. I'm a product of everything I listened to and stopped thinking about it. And that was the Lifer record that I did, which was in 2013, which was like, this is what I sound like. I'm just like, you know, I wear my influences on my sleeve. And then came the recovery records, and that brings us up to today. How'd I do?
You did very well. You completely got it in a little package there for us, and gave us the history.
That was the Reader's Digest version.
There you go. I do have Lifer here. Maybe we can get to something off that at some point before we say goodbye. We got about another hour left here. We do have some more music to get to. While we're on the topic of James Joan Jett, one of the songs you wrote that strikes home, and I've played this for a number of years now because I actually wrote a piece for Marion County here in the Indiana, Northwest Indiana area, and I've gotten to actually hang out in Fairmount and Marion, and you wrote a song called Riding with James Dean, and Dean is a huge, larger-than-life figure here in Indiana. We're right on the border of Illinois, Indiana here with our radio station. So I want to play that song, but you were a co-writer on it. Is there a Dean connection? And I'm wondering, because I know in New York, Dean was, he spent a lot of time in theater there, and a friend of mine, David Lohr from New York, opened up the James Dean Gallery in Fairmount, and Lenny, his buddy, used to do fashion in New York, and I just know New Yorkers are really big on Dean. Were you a big fan? What's the story behind the song?
Oh yeah, I mean, of course I was a big fan. You know, take a white T-shirt, a pack of Marlboros in the sleeve,
right?
I could make something up for you, but I swear to God, I can't remember why was that about. It must have been Joan had an idea or something like that about, let's write this about James Dean. I could not tell you why. It's a cool song. I remember that, you know, but I don't know why. But, you know, love James Dean. Also love Dean Martin.
There you go.
You know, I mean, I love all those 50s actors, man, that played that whole crew, the Brando crew, the James
Dean
crew.
The tough guys. The man's man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Just cool stuff. In fact, I watched On the Waterfront the other night, and I was like, you know, if I ever go on the road again, my hotel name's going to be Johnny Friendly.
Well,
who was the villain in that movie?
Let's take it back to 1988. This is a song that my guest Ricky Bird co-wrote while he was a Blackheart. This will probably be the only Blackheart song we get to because he's got such great music to get to on his own. But one of my favorites, it's a local hit because I've been playing this for years on every station I've been on. Let's Go Riding with James Dean and Ricky Bird. Love that guitar at the end there. Tasty, tasty stuff there, Ricky.
Wow, dude, I haven't heard that in, I can't even imagine.
Wow, that's got to be one of my favorite songs.
Really cool stuff, good guitar stuff.
Yeah,
I also love my little Jimmy Page riffs in there at the solo.
Yep, that's going back to 1988, Joan Jett and the Blackhearts, the Up Your Alley album. Maybe not the first one you think of when you think of Joan, but certainly one to invest in there. That was written by my guest today, Mr. Ricky Bird, who has
co-written.
Co-written, got to get that right.